Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Studio Tulsa is back today, and we speak with Native American filmmaker Sterling Harjo. Harjo has directed three feature films and a feature documentary, which have all concerned stories and content about American Indians. His latest film, Miko, premiered at the Los Angeles Film Festival in June and had its Tulsa premiere earlier this month. The film was shot mostly around Tulsa's Whittier Square and also along the Arkansas River. It tells the story of a homeless Native American parolee as he struggles to find a place in the outside world. Living on the streets, he reconnects with an old friend, Bunny, and is befriended by a kindly waitress. But Miko's homeless community is tormented by a dangerous bully and thumper, and Miko, recalling his grandmother's teachings, rises up to confront the danger. The film shares the story of the homeless and features many extras from the Iron Gate Soup Kitchen and tells that story through the voices of a community mostly unseen and unknown. Miko was just accepted for the Toronto International Film Festival that was announced yesterday, and it'll be shown at that festival in September. There'll be a special benefit showing benefiting Iron Gate at Trinity Church this Thursday, August 20th. The showing is free, but of course donations will be accepted. Reception begins at 5:30 and the screening at 6:30. Sterling Harjo is my guest today. Sterling Harjo, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And congratulations on the film Miko.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of how Miko came together. What was the original germ of an idea for the film?
In between films, I'm pretty much kind of banging my head against the wall, trying to figure out what to do and what to write. And, you know, I'll have various scripts. Like some will be up to page 30, some will be to page 10, some will be page 1. So I'm always working on something, but I really kind of wait for something to click in. And with this one, it was... I usually have to get inspired somehow, but I'd always wanted to make a movie in this world of like homeless Native Americans in Tulsa. And because whenever I left home, it being Oklahoma, me moving to Tulsa, I mean, I'd traveled to different places, lived in New York and Austin, whatever. But coming back to Tulsa, I kept recognizing that I never saw Native people in Tulsa. And, you know, my whole family's an hour and a half away, and it seemed like all the Indians lived outside of Tulsa. And so I was living – I don't like living at 191st and Yale. So I was in Midtown, and I kept noticing that I would never see – a lot of Native people. And then I started noticing, and I feel like I just kind of missed that, the humor and the kind of familial aspect of that world. And I started noticing homeless Native people. And I was like, you know, and then I would sit there and watch them, which is kind of creepy, but I would watch them and like, you know, they would be laughing and hanging out and having a good time. And something just reminded me of home. It was probably the humor, and I could see them having a good time, even though there was obviously problems. It just seemed like they were a family, and I think I was missing my family at the time, so, you know, I just kind of longed for that. But, you know, I just kept that in the back of my head. I did for This Land Press, I did a mini doc. I was just driving down the road, and I saw this homeless man walking, and so I pulled over, and I asked him if I could interview him, and his name was Jimmy Washington, and I believe he's still around. You know, he's a Cherokee man. He's a fluent speaker of Cherokee, and kind of talked about how he had no one to talk to in Cherokee. And so I did this video on him and just kind of got more and more interested in that world and paid attention to it all the time. And
I think once you started paying attention to it, then all of a sudden you're seeing us all around you.
Yeah. Once you start paying attention, I mean, especially it's everywhere, and then you can't avoid it. And then, you know, I was trying to figure out what to do, and I was watching an old Werner Herzog movie called Strozek, and there was something inspirational about, you know, it was kind of the way I like making movies anyway, but I watched this movie where a man had made a whole film where it looked like he used real people, just went into locations and started shooting. The people that were in these diners were still in the diner, you know, like he didn't change anything. He just kind of incorporated the whole world into this film. And that was really what I needed. And I was like, I'm going to create the story that takes place.
It seems
in that
like
world.
You did that too.
Yeah, totally. I did. I mean, you know,
there's a diner scene where it's looking like those are ordinary diners.
Yeah.
Rather than the extras.
Yeah. That was one of the things that I insisted on, was that a lot of times whenever you shoot films, you'll ask when their off hours are at a diner or a restaurant or wherever you're shooting, you'll ask them to shut down if you have money to pay for them. We didn't have any of that, but I also wanted the kind of reality of that world or of that space. And so I would ask them if we could film during working hours. And so we would just bring the crew. We'd be like, we'll make our crew as small as possible. We'll set up outside. We will work around you. And so we would bring lights and everything in and camera gear and actors. And everyone was so cool. I don't know if it's an Oklahoma thing or what, but like no one mugged the camera. I would just kind of explain to the people that were there, you know, like we'd have a sign up front and be like, you're going to be in this film if you come and eat, you know, I hope you're cool with that. And everyone was so cool. No one ever, I never caught any, I've made movies with hired extras where they're hamming it up, looking at the camera, overacting, whatever. Everyone in the background of my film is so natural. It's pretty great.
There's one scene where they're in the diner and they're, I think it's before they take a trip or somewhere. And obviously the table behind them are real diners and they're not looking at the camera. And I thought that was so cool because it was like incredible extras because usually extras are, you know, they want to get their face on the camera, you know?
I do have to give props to the Red Dirt Rangers because they played background extras in one of the diner scenes and did a pretty darn good job at it.
Well, so once you had this idea, you start seeing Native American population homeless here in Tulsa. You said, how did the script come about? I mean, what was the story you wanted to tell? Because you tell this story, there's a mystic story, and it gets into really a lot of the deep traditions of a lot of Native Americans, of light and darkness and of people who have lost that light.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the central theme of the film.
You know, I feel like I wanted to make a film that kind of honored the traditional side of my life, I would say. You know, I just made this film. I grew up in these, which would be considered traditional Indian churches. I grew up in those churches and then, you know, started going to ceremonial stuff. And I just made this film that was about Christian hymns. Creek Christian hymns. And so I just felt like I wanted to honor the other side of me and that world and kind of the conversations that you have with people in that world. And so, you know, I wanted to make this movie, but I didn't want it to be a film about the broader social issues of being homeless. I wanted it to be told from within that world, not an outsider looking in. So it was important for me to find a story that I felt true to that world that could take us through it instead of like Sterling Harjo, who's never been homeless before, telling a story about that world, you know?
You know, and by trying to do that, I think you actually told a stronger, bigger political story than you would if you tried to do it overtly because one of the central tenets of the film that I think gives us a sense of what it's like to be homeless is this idea of, you know, there are times in the film where it's 2 or 3 minutes where nothing's happening. And really, that's the central tenet. I mean, as far as I can see, that's one of the central tenets of homelessness. You've got to while away hour after hour after hour. And there are specific times where, whether it's going to the day center for the homeless or Iron Gate for a meal, or there's a time when you can safely wash up somewhere, or a time when you can sleep, which oftentimes isn't night, it's daytime.
Yeah, totally.
You know, I think that's one of the interesting things that you, from telling the story on the inside, that viewers get a sort of sense of that sort of long periods of time where nothing's going on and you're just passing time.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I was just trying my best to tell a story that I'd never been homeless and I'd only hung out with a few people. It was really encouraging when I took my actor and we started eating at Iron Gate and I would tell people, I kind of recruited people to be in the film from Iron Gate and I would tell people the story and they would all be like, oh, that's just like blah, blah, blah. It's his story, you know, or they'd be like, it's just like what happened to me. And, that was encouraging just that they felt it was true, you know, and then they would say things like, this is important. Feel like this is important to get out there, you know? But it's true. It's like, you know, Bob Dylan makes good songs and then you like his songs. Well, then you get a message out of those songs, you know? And I feel like, just my style has always been to, whether it's about Native representation, whatever, it's always been to tell a good story first, and then people get out of, you're going to reach so many more people if you have a good story that people can relate to as a human, and then they extract whatever meaning they get out of it, you know, and I think that was the approach for Miko as well.
In the course of Miko, you obviously had to do some research. What sort of research did you do to sort of understand, to help tell that story from within as opposed from the outside?
You know, I talked to a lot of people that I knew, listened to stories. I would talk about people that were on the street, or that had family that was on the street. So I would talk to people about that. For the most part, you know, like sometimes I feel like you know, it probably sounds cheesy, but I feel like I was meant to make that film, and I feel like it would never be made if I didn't make it. And something about the story, putting myself in that story, like, I just came up with it. I mean, there's so many things in there that I really look back at even now and just like, I can't believe that I wrote that detail because it might be true to that world or whatever. And then hearing people talk about it and kind of confirm to me what it's like, you know, being on the streets. It's just a weird thing for me. And as much as I would like to say I researched a lot, I didn't. I researched a little bit, and then I started hanging out and getting really familiar and comfortable with some of the people from Iron Gate, and just kind of confirmed a lot of my story. But as we would shoot and as I would talk to them, I'd hear stories and I'd add little stuff here and there. But for the most part, you know, I just tried to imagine, like, how does someone end up there? I was eating at Coney Island one time, and which happens, you know, in the film, they're eating there as well. But I was eating at Coney Island. I saw this young man, and he had a backpack on, and it was an OU hat on. And you could tell that, you know, he had an iPhone, was listening to music, but you could tell that he'd been traveling and probably going to end up on the streets. And so that was kind of inspiration for the younger man, and yes, who's actually played by my brother, Trey.
Right.
It was inspiration for that. So there's all these different people that come into this world, and that's how it is out on the street. It's like you meet different. There's no two people whose story is the same.
They're the people who are very docile.
Yeah.
And of course, the antagonist of this film is, and you have this, I guess, Native American legend or part of the church of this evil. Yeah. What is it, like an evil presence or evil?
Well, yeah, it's a traditional kind of basically, like, I wouldn't call it superstition.
Evil angel, is it?
Yeah, it's not necessarily an angel. It's a person that, and you know, it's something that I don't explain in the film because I kind of like.
You like it, you can leave it as a mystery for us.
Yeah, and so.
You just give hints about it.
Yeah, and you know, you grow up, it's the boogeyman. You know, you grow up, when you're Creek or Seminole, you grow up with this boogeyman. And even non-Indians down where I'm from know about it and talk about it. And it's called Stegini, and it's basically like someone that's a shapeshifter, someone that changes themselves into an owl and, you know, causes harm to you, basically, is the idea. And so that was the boogeyman. It's like, you watch out for those Steginis in the yard. You know, like, you couldn't go outside. That's how you got scared, you know. So he's sort of this modern telling of – and, you know, I don't really say in the film if he is an actual Stegini, a person that does this, or if it's something that the main character's created, you know.
Right.
To make
I think the audience implies it too.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and in the course of the film, Miko runs into this guy, and again, it's portraying a real incident, which is you have homeless people who are completely harmless. You know, they're just trying to get by day to day, and whatever issues are going into the reason they're homeless, and then you have these other people who are basically preying on them, and this is what the Stegini is doing in the course of this film, and that's what Miko has to confront. But I love, there's one little scene in the film where Miko he's visiting a relative, right? He's gotten out of jail at the beginning of the film, and he's sort of on the streets. Nobody wants to take him in, and he goes into a friend or a relative. And,
yeah, played by Casey Keene.
Yeah. And she's got an owl over here. Oh, and immediately he's like, he walks in the room, switches that owl, turns that owl away from him.
Yeah, we were sitting there and there was this owl. And every friend that I have knows. I mean, like, I have friends that have hacked my Facebook and wrote, like, you know, I'm doing a new project, please inbox me owl photos or whatever. And so everyone knows, like, you know, I get texts all the time with owls just because they know how I am. And it's like the way I grew up, you know, people are like, I don't
know. So owls are bad
news. Yeah, it's just kind of like a bad omen and bad news. Or they're a witch that can kill you, you know. So so not good on any front. But we were sitting there, and my makeup artist, Devin, we were at her house shooting, and she had this owl figurine on the desk. And I mean, it'd be funny if he just turns it to not face him, you know. And I try to find any kind of humor like that in any part, because it's a heavy movie too, you know.
It is. Yeah. My guest today is Sterling Harjo, a filmmaker. His latest film is titled Miko. It'll have a special screening this Thursday at Trinity Episcopal Church, benefiting Iron Gate Soup Kitchen. In fact, many of the extras in the film are, I think you found them at Iron Gate, as a matter of fact. The reception takes place at 5:30, the screening at 6:30. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Talk a little bit about your actors. Rod Rondeau, Rondeau is just does an amazing job as Miko. And one of the things I really loved was this sort of repressed feeling that he has through most of the film until he confronts this spirit person. And then all of a sudden, it's like he changes utterly. And you just think of him as being sort of this very quiet actor. And then all of a sudden, once this weight is lifted, all of a sudden it's a completely different actor. It was really, he really did a fine job in the film.
You know, he's never played a lead before. He was in, well, he was the one role that he's had. He's mainly a, he's a stuntman. He's been a stuntman for a long time. You know, anytime he was just on the Leonardo DiCaprio film, like riding horses and getting shot or something, you know. But he wants to, you know, he also wants to act, like, you know, in regular films. And he was cast in a film by Kelly Reichardt called Meek's Cutoff. And he was one of the lead roles. He doesn't talk, but he does talk at one point, but the other people can't understand his language. So I saw him in that, and he's just like, there's such a like intensity to his face, and he has this quality of being like both, he can get really dark really quick, or he's super friendly and nice. And, you know, just to tell you how good of an actor he is, I mean, you wouldn't believe what he's like in real life. You know, I mean, he's the most gregarious guy, like every woman's sweetheart, every guy's partner. And, you know, he's hugging everybody he meets and, you know, just loud. And, like, you know, if he's in a restaurant, everyone hears him.
And so and then when he's in this film, he's just so quiet.
Well, yeah, and he showed up like that. And I'd never met him before. I'd only seen him in this performance. And I just cast him kind of blindly, basically. And he loved the script. And I was like, well, come do it. And so he came out. I started taking him to Iron Gate to eat and meeting people. And then, you know, we started shooting. And as soon as we started shooting, I knew it was right, because he just kind of like switched into gear into this guy. And he became this person. And you know, it was a really rough shoot. There were, he got sick in the middle. We had to like switch the schedule around. There was a time when we were shooting at night where when he was sick, cause we had no money and had to keep going, where he would literally go to sleep off to the side. We would get the scene all the way ready to go. All he'd have to do is act, pull him out. He'd do the scene, and then he'd go right back to sleep. And like, that's how sick he was, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. So he's just really great, and I saw him, and I, at first I thought about casting him as the kind of bad guy in the film, and that's what was going to happen. But then one day I thought of him as – I just started thinking of him as the lead actor, and all of a sudden everything got better for me. I was just like, man, that's it. Like, because the lead character has to have darkness to him and light, and it just worked out great.
No, he's a very much a stoic character. I think it's kind of, that makes it really difficult to do a movie around a character that is in fact stoic.
Yeah.
Because it requires great acting, because you have to communicate with facial expressions, you know, very subtle facial expressions. Yeah. What's the challenge of doing something like that?
I don't know. You know, I feel like the movies now, people talk too much and,
always monologuing.
Yeah. And you know, like, you watch these romantic comedy, anything now, and it's you know, there's no, like, the audience doesn't have anything to work with. It's like, you're not asking anything from the audience except to, like, which is great, you know? Like, I loved Mad Max. Like, I loved that, even though there wasn't a lot of talking in that. Like, I loved it. It was an action film, so that's kind of not what I'm talking about. But, you know, you go see some of these films, and people are talking all the time. And it's almost like people don't believe that the audience has patience any longer, and I don't know. I love that pace. I love like European cinema. I love, that's just what I got into, and it's what I gravitate towards when I watch stuff. So, and it gives my film, and you know, I feel like, but it's also like, as much as it is like the pacing of like maybe living on the streets, it's also, I feel like Oklahoma. I also feel like it's my Native American family, you know, just like life, you know, I always say that, like, my family, you know, have so many great storytellers, and just, like, could tell a story that's amazing, and it won't be about anything. It'll be about going down to the store, but it's how they tell it that's amazing, and I've always kind of strived for that, that, like, how my people in my family, certain people in my family can tell a story. I've always tried to get that and capture it in my films, so.
Well, I think what you're getting at is the idea of what's left unsaid in real life is as important as what is said, oftentimes.
Yeah.
And in film, a lot of times, it has to be spelled out.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's one of the things your film does, is it does leave things unsaid, and it's up to us as viewers to decode that
yeah.
unspoken conversation.
Definitely.
My guest today is Sterling Harjo, a filmmaker whose latest film, Miko, is a story of being a Native American homeless in Tulsa. Wonderful Tulsa shots. I guess you shot in Tulsa. It looks like you shot in Pitcher. I'm not sure. You did shoot in Pitcher.
I shot in Pitcher, Tulsa, and in Maud, Oklahoma.
Maud, Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And it'll have a special screening this Thursday at Trinity Episcopal Church, benefiting the Iron Gate Soup Kitchen. Reception at 5:30, the screening at 6:30. It's free, but donations are accepted to benefit Iron Gate. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, how's the film been doing so far? I know you've had your premiere and you're working the film festival circuit. I know there's a big film festival you can't talk about yet that it's going to be coming up next month.
There's a big film festival that starts with a T. and I can't announce it yet because they haven't announced it. But, you know, we'll just kind of slip that in there. That's exciting. It's a big festival. And the film was invited there. And, you know, a lot of times some of these festivals won't take films that aren't premieres. So it's kind of a big honor to be asked to show your film after your film's already premiered. My film premiered at the LA Film Fest.
And then what was the reception in LA?
It was great. You know, LA's weird. I think LA's like, I've never had a good, I've had good screenings there. It was a good screening, but I've never had inspiring screenings, you know, where it's like, this is why I do it. It's always like, you know, people don't like driving there, you know, so half of your friends will show up. It takes an hour to get anywhere. And everyone's so used to watching films. It's just kind of like,
it's like they're dissecting it to the nth degree. Maybe.
It would be like if we went, you know, like an Oklahoman went to like talk on, I don't know, oil leases or something, you know, like they're just over it. It's like their industry.
In Washington State or something. Somebody knows very little about it.
And so so it was fine though. It was a big crowd. People liked it. It was just, you know, the energy of an audience you can just feel. And then we went to Oklahoma City and it was like, it was just amazing. It was like Dead Center Film Festival. And the screening there it was packed. People were like, I mean, I had like elderly Indian people like, getting turned away at the door and they're like asking me to get them in and I can't. And it's, you know, it was like packed. It was awesome. And you know, I always love when it's just like the humor hits right. The drama hits right. And you can just feel it. Then we had a screening at Circle Cinema, which also was great. It was, similar to the Oklahoma City screening. So, you know, it's been doing good and we'll see what happens after this festival. Hopefully we get some sort of distribution and, get it out there.
And talk about getting distribution. It's so tough.
It is.
Especially for an independent, a truly independent film these days. I mean, the independent films that get picked up, they're not really independent
anymore.
And also, I have to ask, I get a sense that, you know, for every Smoke Signals, there's 10 other Native American created films that just never get a shot.
Yeah, I mean,
I would think there's still a lot of prejudice against the Native American film.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, you know. But, you know, it's a business and they don't have to want to see films with Native Americans. So, you know, it's kind of a weird position to be in where it's like, oh, I want to make films about Native people, but it's in an industry that doesn't consider that very marketable. You know, unless they're in Buckskins and with Adam Sandler and whatever, you know, it's like... you know, there's a certain narrative that I feel like they like to keep going. But, yeah, man, I mean, you know, you tell me when you figure out what I should be doing. it's funny because it's like all my films have been distributed. None of them have been distributed to the level where it's like a lot of marketing goes into the films. They just kind of come out. They're on Netflix and they're available and stuff, which is great. Some people don't get that. But... you know, it's a hard thing. But I've always just kind of stuck to my guns and said, I'm going to make these films. And sometimes that's good and sometimes that's bad. But, you know, we'll see what happens. It's a big festival. I think this film has a pretty good chance of doing something more. The last film, this may be the last time, has done well. It's just the days of, like, independent film. I mean, if Smoke Signals were made today, no one would see it, you know. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the thing. I mean, films aren't getting made for that amount of money anymore, and films aren't getting distributed that are made for that amount of money if they don't have stars in them. So
what do you do? I mean, you do get distribution, but still, even getting distribution, it's pretty tough. You know, do you sort of market it yourself, or do you leave it to the distributors?
Well, a lot of it's distributors. I market it myself. I mean, I have enough of like...
I mean, I think there are certain places like, you know, in the West and in certain, you know, where there are large
Native... The one place I feel like we haven't tapped into for Native film is Europe. I feel like they would be big there if it was packaged in the right way. And I have enough of a following of fans in the Native communities that they'd get out there pretty far and wide. And I go to, you know, different indigenous... You know, there's filmmakers, First Nations filmmakers in Canada and... you know, there's a whole circuit basically of like showing these films and they kind of have a good long life. And then, you know, I've made my money off of getting asked to speak and lecture and talk about my films and present my films and whatever. And, you know, commercials and TV shows and whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's like that's been, you know, if I don't know what I would have done. I would have still made films, but going into it, I thought, you know, it was like, we just got finished. Whenever I started making films, it was right after, you know, Reservoir Dog, all that stuff, Smoke Signals, that whole 90s era of independent film. So in the 2000s, I was like, well, this is going to be the same. You know, I'm going to have a film, boom, toast to the town, get to make whatever movie I want to make after that. Just didn't, you know, it doesn't happen like that anymore. So I've just kind of dug in and decided to keep making these films.
And you're telling real stories too.
Yeah, exactly. It feels good.
Well, Miko is excellent. It really does tell an important story that needs to be told. And I think, you know, hopefully when people see this film, they will look differently as they're driving down the streets, as they're driving through certain parts of downtown, as they're driving next to intersections where there is, you know, right next to an interstate overpass, there may be somebody living there.
I mean, you can't, you know, like even noticing it once, you notice it more. But after making this film, what was crazy is being on the streets, you realize that it's a world you had no idea about. And all of a sudden it comes alive for you. Once you're there and you start engaging that world, it comes alive and it's everywhere. And you realize that there's a whole other world that no one sees. It's just like everyone's got blinders to, not even on purpose, but it's just because they don't know what to look for. And then, you know, and then now for sure, like I just notice people on the streets a lot more, you know, it's easy. It's a hard thing to avoid, which I wouldn't want to. And which, you know, I hope that this film can at least put a human face to this one story about someone being homeless.
The name of the film is Miko. Sterling Hardrill, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Native American and Oklahoma filmmaker Sterling Hardrill speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest feature film, Miko, will have a special benefit showing this Thursday, August 20th at 6:30, a reception at 5:30 at Trinity Church in downtown Tulsa. It's a special benefit screening for Iron Gate. Admission is free, but donations will be accepted. By the way, it just announced yesterday that Miko had been accepted for showing at the Toronto International Film Festival in September. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.